Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, Episode 6, 3D and Room Acoustics with Anthony Grimani.
Hey there, welcome to Home Theater Geeks. I'm Scott Wilkinson, the editor of UltimateAVMag.com and the online editor of HomeTheaterMag.com, the website of Home Theater Magazine. This week's guest geek is Anthony Grimani, one of the industry's most preeminent home theater designers and consultants, and the president of Performance Media Industries at PMILTD.com. Hey, Anthony, welcome to the show.
Hi, Scott. I'm saddened to hear that you didn't refer to me as one of the world's preeminent home theater geeks.
Oh, I should have. You're right.
You should have.
One of the world's most preeminent home theater geeks.
I'm proud to be part of that club.
Excellent. Wonderful. Well, as you know, all the conversations we've had together, you and I, over the years, I've always found them to be very, very illuminating, so to speak. And so I'm really looking forward to talking with you here and helping you share some of your insights with our audience. So you survived CES okay?
I did, all in one piece. I actually had a good time there.
Yeah, so did I. You know, a lot of our colleagues, they grumble about CES and they go, oh, I don't want to CES. But I really enjoy it. I guess you do too, huh?
I haven't enjoyed it in the past. There's been times where it's definitely grumble time. The show's too big. There's nothing new to see. But this year, maybe because I'd skipped it a few years in a row, I felt renewed and energized going there. And
I
saw a bunch of cool things and ran into a lot of people I hadn't seen in a while. And it was fun. I enjoyed it.
Now, you didn't have a booth there, right?
I didn't, no.
No, so you were free to wander around.
I was a free agent. A free geek.
A free geek. Is that anything like a free radical, I wonder?
If you're radical, that makes you a free radical geek.
So what'd you see that particularly tweaked your fancy?
I actually spent a bunch of time looking at the 3D demos. I'm very intrigued.
As we all did, yes.
We all did. I'm intrigued by the technology direction. I have certain opinions about it. I wanted to see how the video implementations were working and who was announcing what. So I spent a lot of time doing that. Mm-hmm. I also spent a fair amount of time in the high-end audio in the halls of the high-end audio at the Venetian Hotel.
Right.
And looked at a bunch of stuff there, and that was interesting and neat to see.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get a little bit into your opinions about 3D. You said you had some. Where would you like to start on that?
Well, let's see. I guess I should qualify it by saying that for my eyes, it doesn't work as well as one would hope. And I'm one of the—I forget what the statistics are, but I'm maybe one of the 30% or 40% of people that doesn't get the perfect effect. And a perfect effect—actually, I should say I don't get the perfect effect. That means that when I'm watching a movie in a theater or I'm watching a demo on video, there are effects that fall apart where my eyes go, whoa, what was that? That wasn't natural. There's something that's blurry. There's something that's pixelating. There's something that's not seeming natural, and I pop out of the movie.
Right.
Which is not the intent. The intent of 3D or any good cinematography is to bring you, to drag you, collar into the movie and keep you there for the full 2 hours.
Right.
So I've had experience in movie theaters where, you know, with the regular, largely the passive glass systems that we have in the U.S., the effects are fun and a little synthetic, and sometimes I find they pull me out of the movie. So I wanted to see how these things were translating into video, especially with all the people introducing systems with shutter glasses.
Right.
And so I looked at that, and I also wanted to see how people were planning to put this on media that users can actually use, or how it's going to get broadcast, what satellite's doing around this. So there it is. I actually... I had a really interesting experience, when was it, about 6 months ago, with a show called the NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters. It's also at the Vegas Convention Center.
Right.
And NHK, the Japanese broadcaster, did a presentation there where they were showing experiments they were doing, and they had in a suite of three different demos, virtually the same program material shot in various forms of 3D. And then shot in what's called Ultra HD 4K, which is 4,000 pixels wide by 2,000 pixels tall. Right. That's an approximation. The actual number is something more complex. But what's known as 4K, and they also showed it in 8K.
Wow, really? They had an 8K display?
They had an 8K camera filming and then a display that was actually two 4K projectors stacked on top of each other, showing an 8,000 pixel by 4,000 pixel picture.
Wow.
So the 4K... The 4K and the 8K material was 2D. Mm-hmm. And by and large in that demo, I preferred the experience of a sharper, bigger, brighter, higher resolution 4K or 8K picture over the 3D version of that.
Yeah, I had the exact same experience at CES in the JVC booth. Did you go see the JVC demo?
I got there just as they were shutting down the last demo, so I didn't get to see it. I'm sorry. I saw like 10 seconds of 2D material on their 4K projector. Looked beautiful.
Beautiful. Gorgeous. I saw the whole demo, and you're exactly right. The 4K material shot at 4K, displayed at 4K, just looked fabulous. I thought it was probably the best image I saw at the show. And then they showed 3D, which was also 4K, but it was with passive glasses and really cheap passive glasses at that. And it wasn't nearly as satisfying as that 4K 2D display. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
Right. So we could get geeky and be micro-analytical about the quality of the picture and go, well, that picture looks better and all of that. What matters ultimately is, are you involved in the movie?
That's exactly.
The whole point of a movie, except for us ultra geeks, and, you know, I'm the president of them all. Don't forget. Don't you forget. I'm the top geek.
You are the top geek, man.
So we can get all geeky about resolution and pixelation and motion artifacts and grayscales and all of this stuff. But ultimately, what matters if you take a step back is how good is the movie and how well does the technology serve the movie? And my feeling currently is, I think it's concurring with what you're saying, which is that if I have to sit and watch a movie for 2 hours and stay involved in it, I am still thinking, even after all the stuff I saw at CES, I'm still thinking I would prefer to have a 4,000 pixel source and display, because I think that it would serve the intent better.
You know, that's so interesting, because Leo Laporte said the same thing when I was on his radio show from CES on Sunday. He said exactly the same thing. He said, you know, between 4K and 3D, I'd rather have 4K.
Right.
And The unfortunate thing is that 4K, in terms of a consumer format, isn't going to happen for several years.
Right.
You know, and we are starting to see it in theaters a little bit. Sony has a 4K digital cinema projector that is installed in some small number of theaters. I don't know how many exactly, but I know there's one out in Thousand Oaks. And if they're really showing 4K material, then that's really worthwhile, and perhaps a reason to go out to the movies than to stay home with your really nice home theater.
Right. So it's going to be one thing or the other. You know, in the history of motion picture or entertainment, maybe I'll call it technological entertainment, which is entertainment where there aren't live people. There's always been a leapfrog between what goes on in the home and goes on in the theater. You know, and it was silent movies in black and white. Then radio came along, so the film industry came up with sound.
Talkies.
And then then television came along, and the film industry came up with widescreen pictures of all the different formats, from Cinerama to Super This and Big Whiz Bang That. So in that leapfrog, it's only natural that the theater industry is looking for something new to compete against high def TV. And only time will tell whether that thing will be 3D or 4K, or maybe 3D 4K. Who knows?
This certainly brings up the question that I've been asking ever since the show, during the show as well. Is 3D something that consumers are really looking for, or is it something that the industry is pushing out there? And if the latter, which I suspect, doesn't that defeat the purpose of doing 3D in the theater, which would be a reason to maybe go out to the movies rather than stay home?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I write for a trade publication called Residential Systems, and a part of my article was on the technology I saw, and a part of the article was on people's reactions, because ultimately it depends on what the people like or don't like.
Sure.
And
sure.
I run into a lot of people who love it. They just go, 3D is fantastic. I love going to the movies. Avatar was the best thing I've ever seen in my entire life. I'm going to go see it 16 times. I'm camping out there. My phone calls are all forwarded to, you know, seat 32 in the theater. I'm staying there. And then I've had people who said, I hate it in 3D. I went back and saw it in 2D and I liked it better. So we do really have an interesting situation here, which it's not just about the technology. It depends on what your psychovisual process is. And that's something that the industry is going to have to contend with. I would say that by and large, whether the emperor has new clothes or not, and whether those clothes are transparent or not, I would say that the general public is loving the idea of 3D, and it only makes sense to bring that to them in the home. Mm-hmm. So the next thing is going to be, well, what is the right? What's the killer app? Is the killer app movies?
Or
maybe
sports?
Not. Sports, it's fantastic, except that when you look at a lot of the stuff, you know, ball players running fast, their legs don't quite work right, and I think we'll get around that. Certainly gaming is fantastic in 3D.
Gaming.
It's beautiful. So I think 3D is fun. I think there's some technology issues to be understood yet for, you know, whatever is the percentage of the population who it doesn't work quite right. And I'm one of those that unfortunately doesn't work quite right for. And then I think also some learning on the production values. Where do you use depth effects, and where is it really not helping?
Right. And can we possibly avoid those cheesy, gimmicky shots of pool cues coming at you and golf balls rolling towards you and so on?
Right, exactly. Exactly. I think Cameron did a pretty good job. I actually had a good long conversation with a guy yesterday who was on his sound crew who did all the sound mixing.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, and an old buddy of mine from my Lucasfilm days, and he had a lot of interesting things to say about how Cameron was working with it, but he was very careful to make sure that the effects were useful to the story he was trying to tell, and I think that's why that movie is successful, is there was not a lot of gimmick. There was just a few little things here and there.
Yeah.
By and large, it was a conservative use of the technology.
Right, so, right, which I think is great. I appreciated that myself. Did you see the movie?
I did, yeah. Yeah, and I actually saw it intentionally in a local, you know, regular theater. I didn't want to go to something where I wouldn't see what the average person would see. And by and large, it worked pretty well. The sound was unfortunately turned down about 6 or 7 dB, which is a real bummer.
It was too soft, really?
It was quiet.
When I saw it in a preview screening, it was way too loud.
Right. In the preview screening, I believe it would be loud, but in a regular movie theater where it was probably too loud, they got enough complaints that they just cranked the level down a lot.
Yeah. Of the technologies that you saw, and we saw shutter glasses, active shutter glasses, and passive polarizer glasses. Also, Dolby has this spectral interference technique. Which one did you find most convincing?
It's one of those where there's pros and cons to all of them. The shutter glasses theoretically should work better. Mm-hmm. They are heavier.
Yeah. More expensive.
And in a number of the demos, they didn't look very good on me. No, on a number of the demos, I actually...
Not exactly fashion statements.
Yeah, no. On a number of the demos, I actually had sync problems where the actual IR, you know, connection between the picture and the glasses over 10, 15 minutes of a demo, once in a while for half a second or a second, went out of sync.
Great
and that's
block,
terrible
yeah.
because suddenly you're like, whoa, what's going on? I'm out of the movie.
Yeah,
passive glasses won't do that. But some of the passive glass demos, which actually were the lesser number, by the way, most of the manufacturers
most of them were active. I agree.
Were active, yeah. They seem to work fine. You know, the demos that I saw at, I can't remember everybody, but I guess most notably the JVC ones seemed the passive glasses worked okay. They had not the cardboard ones outside, but the actual like hard plastic ones. They worked okay.
JVC actually was using the cardboard ones. Must have been somebody else you're thinking
on, of. On the inside they did, but right outside on the TV sets that were along the side of the demo room, they actually had some plasticky ones.
Better ones. Okay.
Better ones. So there's a number of intriguing approaches there, and by and large it works okay. I was also interested to see, completely off the cuff, but interesting, is that both JVC and Toshiba had some 2D to 3D phaco conversions.
Right, Samsung had that as well.
Convincing. Oh, I missed it at Samsung, but they were remarkably convincing. Like, wow, the algorithm that's trying to figure out what's in the foreground, middle ground, and background was pretty good.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought so too. And I also liked it because it was a little more subtle. It was a little more conservative, to use your word. You know, it wasn't so obviously slammed in your face of 3D. And I actually liked it.
Right.
Did you see the Mitsubishi demo?
They had
like a semi parked in the convention center and sent back in the back of Central Hall, I think. And they were showing 3D on their rear projection TVs, the only rear projection TVs left on the market. And I thought that looked surprisingly good. And they were using an interesting synchronization technique. They were using active glasses. But instead of an infrared beam, the image itself would flash a white frame every once in a while. You know, I don't know what the period was, but every once in a while, a white frame would flash on the screen too quickly to really see, but that synchronized the active glasses, which I thought actually worked pretty good. Not only did I not have a sync loss problem, as you describe, but the image even looked a little brighter. This is one of the problems I have with all forms of 3D so far, is that those glasses cut so much light coming into your eye that the picture looks pretty dim, generally speaking.
Right. I agree 100%. That bothers me. It bothered me in Avatar, and it's always bothered me that you probably need a display that's putting out 70 or 80 foot Lamberts or even 100 foot Lamberts before you actually get through all the losses in the system to get back to what people would consider a bright, well-saturated picture.
Right, exactly right. And in a movie theater, you've got, You're ideally at something like 16 or 17 foot Lamberts maximum, and by the time the light passes through your glasses, I'm sure you're in the single digits.
Right. I think the people I've talked to who do calibration for 3D movie theaters say that you lose 60 or 70% of the light level when you pass the glasses.
60 or 70%. Yikes!
Yeah, it's a lot.
It's a lot.
The other thing I notice is the saturation seems to change. So I was sitting there in the Panasonic demo when people were coming in and they had a camera pointed at the audience and you could see yourself in 3D.
Right.
And you could take the glasses off and look at what it looked like without the glasses, put them back on, and then turn around and look at people's outfits, you know, especially people that had colorful outfits. There was a woman sitting behind me with a red coat on. Mm-hmm. And the saturation of that red was completely different with the glasses on, significantly reduced. And, you know, that's just technological issues that I think can be resolved. It's not endemic with the process. It's just
sure.
Where we're at right now with how the glasses are built and maybe some cost issues in how to make them. So
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think the technology has interesting future applications. At the risk of sounding a little bit like a curmudgeon, I may go as far as saying it's maybe a year or two too early to bring this to people because I think a bunch of things are still not resolved. Although it's fun, and if somebody wants to be on the leading edge and have some cool new stuff to have for their family or entertain their friends with, I would definitely say go get one of their TVs that one of those manufacturers is bringing in the next few months and enjoy it because it's pretty fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And now we have a 3D spec on Blu-ray, of course, so the packaged media content is kind of taken care of. I still don't know fully about the broadcast, whatever broadcast standards, plural, there may be. Do you have any sense of that?
I don't unfortunately have any details on how they're going to transmit that. I don't know if they're going to try to compress it down. You know, there was a company called Sensio that was showing their technology. I don't know if you caught that.
I did. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's in. They're using Vizio is using that in their TVs, and they're claiming to be display technology agnostic. Right. They'll work with active glasses or passive glasses or whatever. They take the two images. Multiplex them into one data stream that occupies no more bandwidth than a normal 2D image, and then re-unmultiplex them at the other end. And their demo looked pretty good.
Right. I went and saw that, spent a little time in there. And you know, it's a trickery of compression algorithms, which has been done forever in both audio and video. I didn't see any major flaws with the demos. The projector they were showing was using that white flash synchronization. Mm-hmm. It on fast moving elements, it did have some problems, and I don't know if that's at all endemic in the Sensio topology or if that's just the 3D pickup originally. All this to say that I may suspect that in broadcast where bandwidth is extremely expensive, I wouldn't be surprised that that's what's going to happen, is to find ways to compress the data down into no more than what a standard HD stream looks like,
right,
and
exactly.
Send that out.
Exactly. And then there are issues of how do we define resolution in a 3D image? A guy at TI asked me this question a couple of years ago, and I still don't really have a good answer for that, you know, because it's not only horizontal by vertical, but it's also depth. And as you have pointed out, there's a lot of artifacts that I see also. Maybe I'm part of that 30 or 40% as well. Mm-hmm. Although, or on the other hand, it may be more common than that, where, you know, you see things breaking up, fast action kind of looks a little weird. how do you define resolution there? I don't know.
Right. Both resolution, static, and what may be called temporal, which is what happens under motion conditions, what's surviving the process, the compression, the encoding, all of those things. Yeah, I think we still have a lot to learn, even though 3D is not a new technology. It's been around forever and ever. I mean, stereoscopic photography has been around since, what, the 1910s or something? It's been around forever.
At least. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Wow. Did you see any of the auto stereoscopic displays there? I saw two, one at the Intel booth, and one in a tiny little booth way back in the back of Central Hall from Technicolor, which has been around forever, too. It's the same technology as little kids' cards or little things where you angle the thing one way and you see one image, and you angle it another way and you see a different image.
Right.
Using a lenticular screen. And this is glassesless 3D, which didn't look that great to me.
Glassesless. That's brand new English language. I'm actually looking. I'm looking down at my notes actually from the show. I didn't see the ones you mentioned. I actually did see something else. And bear with me a second as I flip through my pages. There's a company called TCL, a Chinese TV manufacturer, that was showing one of those where essentially through lenticular display. Where if you sit at the exactly right place, what's hitting your left eye is different than what's actually going to your right eye, and you get a 3D image without glasses.
You
move ever so slightly one way or the other, and it all falls apart.
Right,
which
exactly
I'm sure can be overcome through some other trickery. Those are intriguing. Yeah. Those are definitely intriguing. I think the glasses are a problem ultimately for lots of people, and
inherently so. Yeah. TCL, aren't they the company that now makes RCA TVs?
They may be. I don't know.
I think so. That was another interesting thing, just as a side note about CES. I read a report today that there were several Chinese companies, Hisense, Haier or Haier, I'm not quite sure how it's pronounced, and TCL, all had huge booths at the show. And these are Chinese manufacturers that are no longer only doing OEM for other companies, but are in fact marketing their own brands of TV. So this should be an interesting thing to see. I didn't spend a lot of time in those booths, but it is something of interest.
Yeah. Hisense actually had a 3D demo using passive glasses too. Mm-hmm. And it only makes sense. I mean, if these guys are OEM manufacturers for you name it, you know, different brands. It makes sense that they'd want to go out there and promote their own wares and market them. I imagine that will happen.
Yeah, I imagine so too. You mentioned earlier your work at Lucasfilms, and I wanted to just touch on a little bit of your background. You worked at Lucasfilm THX when it was part of Lucasfilm, and also at Dolby. Can you tell us a little bit about what you did there?
I had a good time. And I'm still having a good time. At THX, my main work was to put in place all of the pieces it took to build Home THX, the residential side of the business. So when I joined THX in 1990, it was a movie theater technology, a way for a theater owner to get specifications and technologies to make sure that the movie was playing in the best quality possible. Best quality being, in this case, a complete replica of what happens in a film studio from all the picture and sound performance points of view. Mm-hmm. And the idea was to bring that knowledge into the residential side by helping speaker manufacturers figure out what's a good speaker for multi-channel sound for movies, helping manufacturers of surround decoders build a surround decoder that would actually allow to set up levels, frequency response, delay, everything exactly like it was set up in the dubbing stage, which is where the film is finally mixed. And coupled those elements of know-how together with some standards of performance and together with some technologies that allowed to do the translation from the big sound of a movie theater to the small sound of a living room while maintaining the sense of magnitude and performance that you would hear in a big movie theater. So I did that for about nine and a half years, working with all the different manufacturers and all the distribution channels to get that put in place.
So you were working on the program whereby products get THX certified?
Right. So the process was go talk to manufacturers why this is a good idea, work with their engineering teams to develop a product that would meet those standards, and then help get it through the distribution channel to the end user, because there's a fair amount of education needed in that process.
Sure. And then was it before that you were at Dolby?
Yeah. So I spent 9 years there. And before that, I was at Dolby for 5 years in what's called the licensing division, which is doing a lot of the same work for Dolby's technology. So when I joined, the main technology was still noise reduction for analog cassettes. You know, those little things that would spin around and would actually make music.
I seem to vaguely remember that. Yeah,
a dictation medium that Philips developed for just to take dictation that a few people found you could actually do hi-fi sound with, and in its heyday, in the best possible configuration, you could actually do a copy of a CD onto a cassette tape with the right Dolby technologies, with a cassette deck correctly aligned, and do something that was virtually indistinguishable. You couldn't tell which was which.
Wow.
Which amazed me. I couldn't believe you could put that much sound onto a little piece of tape.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, I would think the noise floor would be higher and dynamic range would be less.
Yeah. The dynamic range originally is only about 65 dB. And with this technology called Dolby S-Type, you can expand it all the way to 90. And the tape
CDs
machine
are 96, aren't they?
96 theoretically, yeah.
Yeah, theoretically. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you get mighty close. Wow.
You get close. Now, when I joined in the mid-80s, it was obvious to me that analog tape is going to go away at some point.
Yeah, sure.
And I was the young, fresh kid that was saying, analog tape's going to go away at some point. We got to do something. And they were like, yeah, whatever. And I was always very interested in surround sound from the early days when the first go around in music quadraphonics was around.
You were around for that even?
I was actually around for that. I was a kid, but our fathers bought this stuff and brought it home, and I loved playing with that. I was a geek at a young age. I have
obviously
to admit.
A member in good standing.
I got in plenty of trouble in other ways, but I like playing with this stuff. And when I joined Dolby, I was very intrigued by the possibility of bringing Dolby Stereo, which at the time was a four-channel format. You know, stereo, right, not meaning two, but stereo meaning stereotypical of real sound.
Right.
And bringing,
from the Greek meaning solid image.
Solid image, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
and bringing that into the home. And I got very involved with a few people there, and kind of what originally was a Skunkworks project to bring Dolby Surround into the consumer's home through a license, through a product development and licensing program. And that got going in the mid-80s. I would say by the late-80s, it was a reality. And by the mid-90s, everybody had it. And now I don't think you can buy anything at any store that doesn't have some form of Dolby something, you know, in the surround sound.
You're right about that.
Yeah.
They seem to have become pretty ubiquitous.
Yeah. So that was, you know, my main contribution, I guess, at the time was to be involved in seeing that this is a fun thing to do. It's funny. I remember and I think in 85, I had brought a prototype circuit of a Dolby Surround decoder with Active Matrix back home. And it was built into a metal box. It was I think it was a recycled enclosure from an old RCA modem. it was, you know, out in the dumpster behind Dolby.
And, right, right.
Hooked that at home, hooked up a LaserDisc player to it, put it on a 30-inch TV set, put a bunch of speakers around the living room, and brought my friends over, just fresh out of college yuppies that are all working at various places making money. And I was like, let's listen to a few movies, a few sections of movies. And what do you think? And they're all like, yeah, I want this. This is great. my extensive market survey of four said that this is cool. And it's what I did a lot of it when I was at Dolby.
Gotcha. Gotcha. So getting back to the importance of acoustics, you and I have talked a lot about this. In fact, you visited Grayscale Studio, my video testing lab for Ultimate AV and Home Theater Magazine. And you're in the process of helping me, thank you very much, to make the best of what is essentially a square room, which is a bit of trouble right there. But I wanted to touch with you for our listeners on some of the basics of acoustics and what we should really be thinking about if we want the best sound out of our home theater.
Well, yeah, acoustics is extremely important. Realize that the best of electronics, the best of source material, the best of electronics, the best of cabling, and the best of speaker is ultimately going to come out of the speaker. Some of it's going to go towards your head and be heard by your ears, and a lot of it's going to spray around the room and bounce around uncontrollably. And your ears then receive that direct sound from the speakers, and then all of this other random sound all the way around you that your brain has to untangle. And the more it has to untangle, the less intelligible or clear the sound is, of course. And the more you're going to have problems with intelligibility, the harder it's going to be to actually localize where sounds are, and the more degradation you're going to get. And I've heard rooms where the acoustics are so bad that very high-end loudspeakers driven by very high-end electronics sound no better than what you could go get at the local, you know, electronic supermarket, not to name any brands, for a few thousand dollars.
Sure.
So, interestingly enough, Scott, I don't know if I ever told you this story, but my first run-in, serious run-in with acoustics was actually at the first demonstration of Dolby Surround Pro Logic.
Oh, really?
Have you heard the story?
No, I haven't. Go for it.
It's kind of interesting. So here we are. Dolby in 1987 introduced Dolby Surround Pro Logic, which was an enhanced form of surround sound encoding and decoding that could give you much better separation, where you could much clearer hear where sounds were placed in the surround sound field. And we go to the what actually is the world, I think still the world's largest consumer electronics show called the Funkausstellung, which is in Germany. It means a radio show. Funkausstellung, Fahrvergnügen. we get this demo room that's all hard surfaces, and we put chairs in them that are, you know, metal chairs with plastic tops and backs, and put a bunch of speakers in there and proudly display our first ProLogic surround decoder actually made by a manufacturer, which at the time was NEC. A lot of people don't remember this, but the first ProLogic decoder, plomp it down and play an SVHS demo reel of German program material that we'd assembled at a local post-production house from a bunch of different movies, and turn it all on, and it's not working. It just sounds like giant mono. Sound is coming from everywhere all the time. A notable sequence from Return of the Jedi in German, of course, but Return of the Jedi, where speeder bikes are going from left to right in the sound field, they're not going anywhere, and I'm suspecting a hardware problem.
Right.
So, you know, I start banging on the surround decoder, go get a different one, change wires. Now I'm suspecting the player, and start, you know, swapping players around. Nothing's working. Now I'm suspecting the actual demo tape. And we actually go back to the production facility and recut a new tape, come back, no, nothing. It's still not working.
Wow.
So now it's 2 o'clock in the morning. The show opens at 9. I'm sitting on the floor. A bunch of Germans are running around in German going, and I'm hearing, Dolby. And I'm like, what is going on? And I'm sitting there, I'm sitting there looking at the room going, what is going on? So I start actually disconnecting speakers and just let the left speaker play on its own just to see what's coming out of the left speaker. And sure enough, in the speeder bike scene, when they're supposed to go from left to right, there's sound in the beginning out of the left speaker, and then it goes away. So it's like, well, the speaker's working. It's getting the right signal. What's happening? And then I have the aha moment. The room is a giant echo box. Everything that's leaving the speakers is bouncing around and returning to the ears at the listening position, mushed out by the room.
Yeah.
And I was like, what am I going to do? So I rush back to the hotel. I knock on the door of all the people involved in the demo. It's 2:30 in the morning. I steal their bedspreads, bring them all back to the convention center. Nail them all up on the walls to see if that was going to do something. And sure enough, bada bing, bada boom, now we've got surround sound. Thank you very much.
Oh my God.
That's
hilarious.
It's funny. And that was like such the realization. I mean, it was trial by fire, boot camp of acoustics, which is
seriously,
this stuff matters.
Yeah.
And the journey after that was a study of acoustics. Understanding, you know, what it is, and 9 years spent at THX, where THX spent a lot of time worrying about acoustics, and then 11 years ago, I started a company that does nothing but focus on acoustical engineering. My new company, PMI Ltd., is a specialty acoustics organization that focuses on high quality home theaters and screening rooms, and just obsesses endlessly and fruitfully, I'd like to say, on acoustics.
Absolutely.
So what we've seen over and over and over again is rooms that have very competent gear that have had no attention to acoustics, and we provide some grade of acoustic solution, and invariably, boom, the sound is back. And just like with loudspeakers, you have different grades of solutions. You have entry level, you have mid level, you have high level, and depending on your budget, you can get different grades of it, and you can do all the studies and the engineering, and even today with computers, you can model it. I can actually build a three-dimensional computer-assisted design model on my laptop right here, and put the room in it and listen to the room over headphones with and without the acoustical treatments, and predict completely what the room's going to sound like.
All modeled in the computer.
And it takes time and costs a little money to do that, but you can go that far, and then you go and equip the room and you listen to it, and it sounds fantastic.
Yeah. Now, you don't want an anechoic room, right? You don't want a room that has no echoes, because that feels kind of creepy.
Right. So there is a concept called anechoic spaces, which is used by loudspeaker labs to measure loudspeakers so that you can find out the sound that's going from a loudspeaker to a microphone, and only that. You don't want to listen there. Those rooms have no sound reflections at all. They won't support the speakers at all, and they'll sound creepy and unnatural to the human being, and they don't work. What you want is the right balance between the direct sound from the speaker to you and the reflected sounds off the sidewalls, off the ceiling, the floor, and the back wall, in the right balance, at the right time, in the right spectrum, with some amount of what's called diffusion, where the sound is scattered to where it feels like it's enveloping you smoothly. And if you do all that, the sound's just amazing.
Yeah. No matter what your equipment. I mean, you could spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on the equipment, but if you don't do the acoustics in the room correctly, you know, that's wasted money.
Right. I sometimes equate that to what happens with tires on a race car. You could have the best suspension, the best engine, the best transmission, even the best driver, and you put bad tires on there, or no tires, and you're not going to win any races. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, that's for sure. So, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there are sort of three basic acoustical treatments. There's absorption, which absorbs sounds of one frequency or another. Diffusion, which sort of sends sounds about in various ways. And I can't think of the third one off the top of my head.
That's actually basically it. You either absorb, well, actually, you could say you either absorb, scatter, which is sometimes called diffusion, or reflect the sound.
Reflector, that was the third one I was thinking of.
And a reflector is a wall. You don't need a special treatment to reflect the sound.
Right.
Or you may want to, in some cases, add a reflector at a strategic location to bounce sounds to a different place than directly to your ear.
Uh-huh.
Now, people in the acoustic treatment business also talk about bass traps.
I was going to say there's a fourth one called bass traps. Right. Yeah.
In reality, bass traps are a subset of absorbers. They strictly speaking, that word is just a colloquial word to represent something that absorbs only bass, usually mm-hmm. through a process of resonance absorption. So mm-hmm. it's a subset of absorption. There's a lot of people selling bass traps that don't really trap bass very well at all. There's those that do a good job. Challenge with bass traps is that they're very difficult to measure because the actual acoustic chambers that would measure those accurately are few and far between. Mm. So the bottom line is you either have a choice of absorbing, diffusing, or reflecting the sounds around. And the whole point of acoustic engineering is to strategize where you put what. What comes back from the walls at what time and with what frequency balance and how you do it. I mentioned the word of frequency balance, and I'm going to say something really important. It's really crucial for the sounds that strike treatments to be treated over a broad range of frequencies. There's a lot of treatments out there made that are relatively cost-effective that only treat a small portion of the sound.
A small band,
so maybe from 10 kilohertz to 1 kilohertz, whereas your auditory system listens over a much wider range. And what happens with that is that the direct sound from the speaker is broad range, but then the treated sound off the wall is a truncated version of that, and then your ear goes, wait, what's up with this? It's not right, and that can actually damage things more than improve them. So look out for the range of efficacy of the products you're looking for, and try to at least go down as far as 500 hertz at least, and preferably 200 or 250 hertz. Below that, you start to get to a point of diminishing return, and if you're doing very high-end audio, you want to go to treatments that are broadband all the way down to 20 hertz.
But you're saying that generally speaking, you want to go down to 200, 500 hertz, maybe as low as 200 hertz, all the way up to 20K, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This discussion could last 6 hours, and you can talk about what happens at higher frequencies.
My
personal preference is to actually taper down absorption at high frequency to try to preserve high frequency energy in the room in a scattered fashion.
Right.
But generally, that's an easy thing to do. The higher frequencies are easy to treat. The low frequencies are the ones where a lot of people get into trouble because, unfortunately, endemically, the products that treat the sound have to be pretty thick. And typically, if they're not at least 2 inches thick, you can pretty much be sure it's not going to work well down to 500 hertz. If the listeners or viewers of this are looking at buying something from one of the multiple vendors out there that's only 1 inch thick, I would say caveat emptor, which is Latin for you're going to have acoustical problems. make sure things are at least 2 inches thick or 3 inches thick and ask for the data. Show me some charts that show the region of operation of this product. A good vendor should have that data. That means that they've gone out and spent money to test it.
Right. Right after CES, I stuck around Vegas, believe it or not, a couple of days and took the THX, what they call the Home Theater 2 course or the Tech 2 course, which gets into some of this, at least at an introductory level. And certainly one of the things that that he said, John Dahl, who in fact is going to be my guest next week, was emphasizing the importance of acoustical treatments and how you can't get good results no matter what the equipment is unless you consider the acoustics of the room, said much the same thing. He sort of said as a general rule of thumb, roughly you're going to cover maybe 25% of your walls with absorbers, another 25% with diffusers. Again, this is a rough estimate. It has nothing to do with any particular real room. You want to go in and look at each case individually, right?
Absolutely, and I'm glad to say I'm glad to hear that the indoctrination has worked well with John. the story still sticks. And that, you know, what's really interesting is when PMI does a design service for somebody, we go through this very sophisticated, complicated analysis and modeling of the room to figure out just how many square feet of absorption, diffusion, base absorption, and scattering you need. And we have these complicated spreadsheets and these 3D models, and it takes us 50 hours of geeking out to look at this. And by and large, the result in most cases is that if you cover between 20 and 25% of the wall surfaces in a distributed way with absorber panels, not all in one place, but kind of scattered around the room, you're going to get to the right result. More than that, and the room will be too dry and will start to have problems.
Right.
And then absorption is one thing. Diffusion is another one. And I usually like to say that diffusion is what turns a room that measures right to one that actually sounds good. And it's really what it's really stepping up in the quality of the acoustics to have scattering devices. And there's a lot of manufacturers of those too. And there's a lot of different styles of 1D, 2D, 3D diffusers. And you kind of have to know where you're going with that, but definitely you need some of both.
Yeah. And then getting down into the bass frequencies, we have a real problem because all rooms exhibit what are called room modes, right? At certain low frequencies in particular, you will have places in the room where the bass is reinforced by the direct sound interacting with the reflected sound, and you have two crests coming together, and you have an emphasis in that particular frequency. And then you, in other places in the room, you have a crest coinciding with a trough, and that particular frequency is canceled more or less.
Right.
And this is, I suppose, partly what bass traps are good for, but really the better solution is to design your room with the right dimensions, right?
Right. So what's people call them modes, I actually like to call them standing wave resonances.
That's more descriptive, certainly.
It's plain English. The reason it's called modes is that the standing wave resonances, I can't even say it, the standing wave resonances are modal, which means that their progression through frequencies actually follows a completely mathematical model that's modal.
Right.
It's even spacing. So just the same way as that black thing with buttons on it is called a remote. It was called a remote control, but now we've just truncated that to call it a remote.
Sure.
People in acoustics call these resonances modes, and everybody that geeks out on acoustics know what we're all talking about. The average person needs to know that it's a resonance, and a resonance means that it's a sound that's going to go into the room and resonate with the room. Why? Because the room is an enclosure, much the same way that a guitar is an enclosure, the same way that a pipe organ is an enclosure. So a pipe organ, you blow sound through it, and at some frequencies, it's going to go, and it's going to resonate.
It's going to resonate at that frequency.
So same thing happens in a room, which is completely understandable. The only way to get rid of the resonance completely is get rid of the walls, which now you don't have a room anymore. You have a garden.
Right.
And right now where I am calling or talking to you from in San Francisco, it's raining like crazy, and I don't want to get rid of the walls. I'm going to keep those.
Yeah, really? Same in L.A.
So standing wave resonances, I actually like to think that it's a five-point – I'm trying to get my hand in front of the camera. Five – I'm trying to illustrate. Five-point solution, actually. There's five things you need to do to get rid of them. And it starts with the right room proportions, because – given that there will be resonances, you want to make sure that the ones that are happening between the front and the back wall are at different frequencies than the left and right wall and different frequencies in the ceiling and floor. If they're all three at the same frequencies, you get a triple whammy, and it's really nasty.
Right. So, for example, a room that's a cube.
A cube is a disaster from a standing wave point of view. With one exception is actually if you made a cube – all the resonances would be focused at very specific frequencies, and you could actually build bass traps for those specific frequencies. And it's a difficult thing to do, but I know a studio designer in Europe that does it that way, which is to make it predictably really bad, and then you can fix it. So, but I don't know how many of our viewers and listeners would want to rebuild their rooms as cubes. They would be 20 tall by 20 long by 20 wide. Given the real estate market conditions, that might not work well. Although maybe now's the right time to buy cubic rooms. I don't know.
I don't know. Most people, of course, are going to have to deal with whatever they've got.
Exactly. So the right ratios of length with height are first step. Second step is putting the seats in places where the peaks and dips are not too audible, because they're not audible at all places. There's places where you won't hear any of the resonances. The third strategy is to place the loudspeakers, the main loudspeakers and the subwoofers, in places where they don't exaggerate the standing waves. And there's ways to do that with the right position of subwoofers to reduce the interaction between the subwoofers and the room, or the main speakers in the room. The fourth strategy is to use bass absorbers, which are, you know, referred to as bass traps, that are either calculated for the specific frequencies or are broadband and they just absorb all the bass, put them in the corners and it'll work. And then the final strategy, the fifth element, where's the camera? Right here. The fifth thing to do is to equalize what's left. So by the time you've done the right room size and the right room dimensions.
Yeah.
Sitting at the right place, you're putting the speakers at the right location, you've used bass absorption. Now what's left is some small errors in the bass, which you can equalize using either a manual equalizer or one of the multiple auto room correction systems out there.
And right.
If you do all that, you will be stunned by the quality of the bass. It'll be tight, punchy, even, clean, things that we're not used to hearing in small rooms that tend to be kind of mushy on the bass.
Yeah, yeah. Now, John Dahl did sort of say in the class we took that these auto EQ algorithms, which you mentioned, work pretty well sometimes. They yield very weird results other times. He didn't seem to be a strong advocate.
How about no comment? I'll say this. The human auditory system is extremely complicated. What goes into the ear, the two ear canals, and it gets processed by our brain is as yet not even completely understood. And there's all kinds of trickery that goes on in here that allows us, by the way, with only two ears to hear three dimensions.
Yes.
Allows us to do echo cancellation. You know, you go into a room that's reverberant and you can perfectly well understand somebody talking, but if you record it with a little microphone, you know, if I moved my microphone away from my mouth here, it would get all reverberant. Whereas in real life, your brain can process out the reverberation. There's all kinds of stuff that our brain does that is not done by a test microphone and an auto measurement and EQ system. And that's kind of the simplest way I could say that they can't be as accurate as a careful manual analysis. So my comment would be that if you want a really good result, if you're doing high quality audio, plan on a manual equalizer and plan on paying a sound engineer to come measure the room. So analyze it, correct for the errors that are visible on the analysis equipment, and then spend at least 3 or 4 hours listening to the results to make sure that in the end what's coming out of the speakers, interacting with the room, and then going into your brain actually sounds good. If you do all that, an equalization method, a room correction method, is the only way to have, in my view, really good quality sound.
Mm-hmm. Some people in high-end audio.
After those four things, and some people in high-end audio might beg to differ, where they think you can, you know, just get really expensive speakers, move them around the room for 6 hours until you get decent sound. But I've always heard flaws from that. So ultimately, the fifth solution in this whole quest for bass control is equalization. And I would say that for very high quality results, I have yet to experience an automated system that works as well as a sound engineer with a good measurement system, good understanding of audio, and the ability to do the fine points by ear. And I know that a lot of people making auto correction systems are going to, you know, call me, park cars outside my building with guys with binoculars and shotguns. But that's been my finding so far.
Sure, sure. Well, one of the main takeaways I have to say I got from this THX class was that doing a full-blown audio calibration of a room, including acoustics, including all the steps that you just mentioned, is far more complex than video calibration. And video calibration is pretty complex.
Right. Yeah, video calibration. Actually, what's really neat about video is there's some very defined parameters video works on. It's very mathematical. It's very analytical.
Yeah.
And so if you have a good display, a good display device, whether it's a flat screen or a projector, and you know, it starts off having the potential to put out good picture, tuning and calibrating that is a matter of 2 or 3 hours between configuration, debugging, and then final tuning.
Right.
A 7.1 channel system takes 2 days to go through. And because you have to start by configuring every piece of equipment and how it interacts with the surround decoder. And then you have to configure the surround decoder for your sound system. And there's a lot of different choices and things you have to select. Then you have to debug the signal path from the source to the surround decoder, to the amplifiers, to the speakers, to the equalizer, preferably.
Right.
And by now, you've spent the better part of a day.
Right.
You have to test that the speakers all work right. And unfortunately, speakers are things that can be dropped by the companies that transport things for us. I see the local truck that pulls up in front of our office. They open the tailgate, and a big box all the way at the top, 10 feet up, falls on the ground. Boom,
ouch!
They throw it back in. And
oh, man.
If that's your high-end speaker, I can guarantee that woofer's bent. So as part of the calibration, you actually want to commission the system. You want to make sure that everything is working correctly.
Right.
And then you can start calibrating. And I find the process takes the better part of 2 days to get through every channel painstakingly so that in the end it all works right. Day one is configuring, verifying, testing, debugging, making sure everybody's behaving in the system. And then day two is actually analyzing, equalizing, and setting with test instruments and by ear all the parameters so that in the end it all works beautifully.
Yeah, yeah. And I have heard the end result, and it really is astonishing. I mean, when you have a room tuned properly and you have the video tuned properly as well, there's really nothing like it. It's pretty amazing.
Right.
One other area I wanted to touch on with you before we go. You at Cedia last September, you and I hooked up and we talked about something I'm calling constant area screen masking.
Right.
And I found that to be a fascinating idea that I had never thought of before.
Right.
Very often people put into their home theaters, a projection screen that is 2.35:1 aspect ratio. So it's a very wide screen. It's close to the widest movie ratio there is.
Right.
And then they mask off the sides when they're watching a 1.85:1 movie. And then they mask off more of the sides when they're watching a 16:9 or 1.78:1 HD TV, always keeping the height constant. So we call this constant height screen masking. But
right.
you advocated to me at Cedia what you called constant area screen masking.
Right.
And I want you to explain a little bit about that and why you think it's better than constant height.
Well, we call this this approach PMI 2.0 as sort of a little wink, nudge to everything that's going on in you know the web 2.0 and everything 2.0.
Sure.
And I think that the impetus starts with the fact that today we're watching a lot of different aspect ratios from 1.33:1, which is 4:3, through 1.78:1, regular TV, to 1.78:1, which is 16:9, through 1.85, 2.35, 2.39, all these different aspect ratios.
Right.
And we're also watching them in lots of different resolutions. The resolution could go from as low as YouTube, which is 320 pixel wide, all the way to 1920 pixels wide. And if I have my way, maybe 4,000 pixels wide at some point.
Exactly.
So how do you decide what the screen is for that? And we found that the concept of a 2.35:1 screen that's constant height doesn't serve all the needs right. And we found that by starting with a canvas that's 2:1 aspect ratio, that you either mask top and bottom or mask laterally, but in which for every aspect ratio and for every resolution, you do the biggest picture you can, the biggest area you can, you end up with better results.
Hmm.
So,
but
PMI 2.0,
if you blow up a low resolution picture too big, it starts looking pretty funky.
Right. So if you watch YouTube on a screen that's 140 inches wide, it's going to look horrible, and you're going to think the projector is broken.
Right.
It's going to look like, I suppose, this picture looks like when it goes over the internet. So YouTube should be watched at a smaller size. So the concept of this technology, this PMI 2.0 technology, is it's really three things altogether. It's a projector that has a zoom that can make a picture small or large, depending on the actual resolution in the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And that's coupled with a projector that, it's coupled with a screen that can either mask down, mask down to either very small or bigger, and either rectangular or more square, depending on the aspect ratios. And that combination, that combined with a control system that can monitor all that, looking at what the program material is, gives you this constantly varying screen where each piece of program material has a different size.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, in a way, it's a completely adjustable and convertible and flexible system that's future-proofed, because you can show anything you want. You're not locked down to it having to be 2.35 or 16x9 or whatever. It does anything. The main idea is it starts with a canvas, the blank screen canvas. It's 2:1, which is partially why we call it PMI 2.0.
Of course, such a masking screen ain't cheap.
Well, right now it's expensive. It's expensive because they're always custom. They're very high quality. They're reserved for very high performance systems, and that's how it always starts. You know, the future will show different results, and you know, projectors are also expensive. That has a zoom that can actually accurately go to the same size every time. That's a very expensive system, and you know, there's no reason why that can't be made more cost effective with volume. So I would say anybody who's doing a high end theater and wants the best of the best of the best, I would say jokingly that constant height is so yesterday, and what you need to do is constant area. And really actually even do a really big constant area, even a screen that's larger than you can use today, because I do believe that at some point we will have 4,000 pixel pictures that can withstand a really, really big picture. And you may as well build your room with a screen that's the right size, even if you don't light it all up today.
Right. So what do you got in your home theater?
Well, you know, I am the proverbial shoemaker's kid. So I've got, I won't say, but I have a projector that's about 8 or 9 years old now.
Oh my God.
I have speakers that are about 12 or 14 years old. The electronics change all the time because, you know, I blow them up all the time. And why? Because I'm always out on the road doing these things for other people. So when I get home, the home theater at home hardly gets used. So it doesn't have a lot of priority to it. So it's embarrassing. I never bring anybody there to show them anything. And that's the reality.
Not like when you're right out of college and showing them Dolby Surround.
Right. How about you, Scott? What do you have at home?
Well, at the moment, I have a Pioneer Kuro 50-inch, the Pioneer Elite Pro 101, which is the last rendition, the last version, I should say, of the Kuro monitor. So it has no sound system, but it can be tweaked to the nines, and believe me, I have. Sound-wise, I'm pretty modest. I have a set of PSB speakers, which work really well. Pioneer receiver. I didn't even go the separates route here, but it's only a two-seat theater. It's a small, very small theater. I'm embarrassed to say I haven't yet done all the acoustical analysis.
Oh, tisk.
I know. I want to do that first at Grayscale Studio at my testing facility, because I'm going to end up doing audio review, product reviews there as well, and I really want the room to sound as good as it can. And I know you know that I have a bunch of treatments that you originally installed in Home Theater Magazine's other testing facility, but now we've moved them over to the testing facility that I and Tom Norton and I have, and we're about to start working on that as well. So next time you're in LA, please let me know, and you can drop by and see how we're doing.
Absolutely. Count on me. I'm glad you're recycling and reusing.
Yes, that's the way to do it. Right. Well, thanks so much, Anthony. I really appreciate your time on the show, and your insight is invaluable.
Thank you, Scott. Great questions.
Thank you. Next week, I want to let you know that my guest geek is scheduled to be John Dahl, who I mentioned earlier, Director of Education for THX. So we'll have a lot to talk about with him, and I look forward to that very much. Until then, geek out.